Come on, people! It's time to live it up!
Hello, this is Tanya McKiernan on The Director's Cut. Rosemary Rodriguez is still in New York doing The Good Wife, but she will be back next week. So I'm here again to bring another guest to you, and I'm so excited to bring this guest. I've known this man since I was born. Mike Post, the amazing composer, who was a friend of my father, Stephen J. Cannell.
Wait. I was his best friend.
His best friend. I was going to say that too, and I didn't say it.
Okay.
But you had a career before my dad, right?
Absolutely. When I met him, he had never sold a script, and I was a made guy. So let's make sure that that's...
You had already won a Grammy.
I had already won a Grammy. I'd already been, you know, I'd already played on hit records. I'd already produced hit records. I'd already arranged hit records. And I was already the music director of the Andy Williams Show. Wow, do I sound sibilant in this? Wow.
It's
in this
fun,
mic.
It's fun, huh?
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
So, but from, and it's fun, and it's interesting to me because I was thinking about doing this, and I've known you my whole life. So it's like, we don't ever really talk about what you do. You know, it's like we're just family, right?
Right.
So I was doing research on you today, and I was like, wow, I didn't know that. You know, and I knew that you had had a Grammy before you and my father worked together.
Right.
But your second Grammy was for Rockford Files.
Correct.
Which I didn't know. And I was like, that's really amazing. And before I get into playing some of your music, you have to tell the story of how you and my father met. It's my favorite.
This is the second time today I've told this story. No kidding. I had breakfast this morning with a buddy of mine, Herb Peterson, and a young guy that wants to be a composer, great bluegrass fiddle player named Gabe Witcher. And I actually was complimenting your father by saying, you know, here's the best note I ever got from a producer on, you know, what kind of music he wanted me to write for a particular thing, which odd story I'll tell later. But so, Herb said, tell Gabe how you met Cannell. I said, well, back before I owned a place in Hawaii or I could afford to really go to Hawaii much, we took our family summer vacations at Balboa Island. So my brother and I shared a house about a block from the ocean. Saturday morning comes, and my brother, who's 5.5 years older than I am and bigger and a lot tougher, we both wake up. You know, we don't talk a lot. We just, 7 o'clock in the morning, we got to go stake out some territory on the beach before our parents are coming down and the kids are waking up and the thing's happening and all. So we walk the block from the house we're renting down to the beach. And it's, you know, I mean, it's overcast. It's a marine layer. And I jump over the seawall, and he jumps over. And right where we tell our parents we're going to meet him, there's all these towels out there. I go, what the hell? It's 7 a.m. Who sticks their towels out here at 7 a.m? So Bud goes, well, I'll go around this little pier here, and I'll see. Maybe there's some room on the other side. Okay. So he goes around there, and I just look at these towels and I go, this is bullshit. I'm going to move these towels. So I start moving these towels, and all of a sudden I hear, hey, quit moving my towels. And I go, what the? I turn around, and I look back, and there's this great big beachfront house, and there's this complete jerk-off standing in a doorway with a iron jaw beard, so stupid, and he's smoking a little thin cheroot. I immediately do not like this guy. I'm going, well, who is this guy? What? And he's screaming at me.
Now, by the way, I heard that the towels were shoved under the pier.
Okay, that was his version of it, you know. Both of us only wish he was here because he and I'd be laughing so hard we'd be peeing our pants. But the truth is, I just moved him a little bit. I didn't shove him under the pier. Right. I moved him a little bit. So, and he's quacking away. And I go, okay, quit moving mine. He's whining like a little girl, you know. So I looked over. I said, hey, I didn't move any towels. Shut up. He goes, no, you shut. So I go, this is it. So I start walking back, and I jump over the seawall, and now I cross the little sidewalk, and I'm on your grandparents' little walkway. And the closer I get, the bigger this guy gets. Now I'm looking at this guy. Jesus, this guy's actually pretty big. I got my hands full here.
And he was like, I can probably take him. That's what he was saying.
Well, he might have been saying that. But I'm looking at him going, you know, I'm going to have my hands full. This is going to be a real deal, you know. And then I hear my brother's whistle and stop me cold. And he screams at me, champ, 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 don't do it, don't do it. So I go, I kind of stop. And now my brother comes up. My brother at the time is 5'11", about 230. And he actually liked to fight. I was a phony. I like to pretend to fight, but my brother actually liked it and really good at it, you know, really good at it. And he goes up and he looks at Steve and he goes, how big are you? I'm 6'1", 6'2", 6'1". What do you weigh? He says, 195. He goes, well, look, he's 5'8", and he weighs about 165 pounds, but he's real tenacious. He'll probably get you. He's determined. But if he doesn't, you're going to be in an ambulance. I'm going to send you to the hospital. I'm going to really do it to you. Go ahead. You can try. You know, maybe you'll get lucky. Maybe you're tougher than he is. But if you hurt him, my little brother, I'm going to hurt you bad. So your father looks at him, looks at me, and I'm all puffed up. And he goes, right. He walks back in the house. He, you know, figures both of us are going to jump him and kill him, you know. Literally, we got back to the sidewalk, and I'm feeling so guilty. I'm going, God, what's wrong with me? I'm a grown-up. What am I doing? I'm a legitimate guy. I'm a conductor of the Andy Williams Show. I'm not just a North Hollywood idiot. This is terrible. So we go back. I tell my wife at the time, Darla, I said, God, I just was such an asshole. Why was I this guy? I moved his towels. I lied like a rug, you know. So I'm feeling really bad about it. We go back down there at 11 o'clock. He's out there with your mom and a playpen and your brother and, you know, and there's, and, you know, Michael John's in a playpen and I'm there. I think Jennifer had just been born, you know, and you were just born.
No, I was actually
in your mommy. Yeah.
I was in my mom's stomach.
So, I mean, it was like really, I walk right over. I said, okay, no excuses. I'm a jerk. I was wrong. I moved him. I lied. And I wouldn't have been near as brave without my big brother. And he goes, oh, it's okay. There's plenty of room. I was just being real territorial and, you know, pissing on fire hydrants and whatever, you know. And so we laughed. He goes, so we start talking. And he goes, what do you do? I said, well, you know, I'm an arranger, a record producer. What have you produced? I said, well, record called Classical Gas and, you know, First Edition just dropped in. He goes, oh, my God, I love that stuff. That's fantastic. And I said, well, I'm the music director of the Andy Williams. Oh, I love the Andy Williams Show. You know, he's like, I said, well, what do you do? He goes, oh, geez. He's like, I'm trying to be a writer, but I've never sold a script. And I look back at this house. I go, it's a pretty nice house. He goes, oh, no, my parents are really wealthy. They've got some money. I don't have anything. I've never done anything. So I'm really struggling. And I said, well, I'd like to read what you've written, you know. You know, you don't have to ask Steve twice, you know. It's like.
Yeah, he'll tell you the story. And
Okay, so it starts out, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, really,
exactly.
Really, yeah, what if, you know. So he runs back with a, you know, some script. And I start reading it. It's really funny. I mean, it was funny right from the jump. It was just funny. And So then the whole rest of the week, we're playing sports together. We're throwing a football. Now, the guy's an athlete, you know. And both my brother and I were kind of athletes. And so, you know, now we're going water skiing together. And we're doing all this other stuff. And I'm going, God, this guy's really great. And he probably would have kicked the hell out of me, you know. So that's how we met. And that's how the friendship started, 1968.
And how long before, after you met him, did he actually sell his first script?
About 6 months, maybe. Yeah, maybe 6 or 8 months. He sold that first script to Dragnet or to something, you know.
I think it was Dragnet, it wasn't Adam 12, was it?
No, not yet. No. Not yet. That was about another 6 months, you know.
Yeah.
And then, Jack Webb noticed him and, you know, took him, you know, made a move on him, and then within a year he was working on Adam 12.
On Adam 12, and then about a year later he was doing Rougher Files, correct?
No.
Was that Toma. Longer? Toma, yeah, right.
Right.
And did you write the music?
Well, here's what happened. So he's working with Roy Huggins, right. and there's nothing I'm doing in TV. I'm a rock and roll record producer, and I'm, you know, I don't know. So he calls me up. He goes, hey, maybe you can help me with something. I said, what? He goes, well, I'm doing this show with Roy Huggins called Toma. And Huggins, composer, is a really good guy. A really good guy, but a jazz guy. And he said, he's written a theme and a score, and it's just awful. It's just not what I want. It's just, you know, it's old, and it's not, you know, it's... I said, yeah. He goes, would you consider doing this? I go, nah, bullshit. I don't want to be messing around with film, television. You know, it comes through a little speaker. I had enough with the Andy Williams show for 2 years. I'm in a rock and roll business. I'm too hip for this room, you know. I'm really too hip. He goes, please. No, I really would appreciate it. And I said, well, I got this buddy of mine, Pete Carpenter, who's an older guy, had done some film, television with Earl Hagen, and did some I Spy and did some sitcoms and stuff. And I said, all right, let me talk to him. And, you know, I mean, I love you, so I'll do whatever, you know. I don't care, but I'll try it. So he goes, okay, great. So we redid the score for the pilot to Toma. And the minute I looked at film without music, I went, oh, I know what that could be. You know, why don't we do this? You know, and then we did it real. I tried to make little hit records out of it, this stuff, you know, and Cannell went, oh, man, this is great. That's exactly what I'm looking for. That's perfect, you know, and, you know, forget the record. There is no record business anymore, and there's still television, so who knows?
You know? Well, and it's I am going to do my low-budget thing, which I told you I was going to do. But one of the things I want to ask you while I'm getting this is your process. Like, you don't ever, do you read the scripts of the shows that you're going to compose, or do you wait until you see the pilot, or what's your starting point?
Either or. Sometimes in the old days, Steven would go, can you go to lunch with me? Yeah. What's up? I want to tell you a story. Remember your dad stuttering?
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Whenever he was excited, or whenever he was like a little bit uncomfortable, like he's pitching something, you know, and he's like, God, I don't want my best friend to just dump on me, you know. So I go, yeah, what do you got? So a lot of times he would tell me a story. And that was great. That was so much fun. He was such a good storyteller. I mean, really.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yes. He was the best. Yeah. I mean, no wonder they bought all those shows, because he was pitching this stuff by telling stories. So, I mean, he was, you know, he's Burl Ives or whatever you want to call it. You know, he was great at telling stories. But, you know, sometimes I read a script. Sometimes I waited until you know, Hill Street. I you know, Bochco never sent me a script or anything. He just said, I want you to see a picture. And I went over there and saw that picture and went, that's... I'd never seen TV like that. You know, I think on Rockford, Cannell called me and said, I want you to read something. Oh, no, don't do that. I just want to tell you this story. And so he told me the story, you know.
So that's my perfect segue and hopefully my low-budget way of playing the Rockford Files theme song will work.
Okay. Well, you had a glass of wine at dinner, didn't you?
Oh, shut up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
And you had two what?
Two martinis, but Tim, did you screw up dinner tonight, Tim?
Totally. Tim's my husband.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait. Wait for it. Was this the first version of the song? Did you play this song for him after he told the story, or did he woof all over you?
No. He, you know, whenever it really got down to music, you know, we put away all the bullshit, you know, and it was like, okay, now we're talking about the real deal. We're not just posturing or replaying who took whose towels and moved them, or whose big brother. You know, now we're talking about the real deal. And I played it for him on piano and sang him the synth part. I went, and I sang it to him. And he went, whoa, that's really hooky. I said, yeah, this is going to be good. Dude, you don't need to know anymore. It's going to be good. You know, a weird thing happened. Somebody sent me a clip from Fallon a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And Fallon's talking to Higgins. That's his guy, right?
Yeah.
And he said, TV theme songs. What's your favorite TV theme song? And Higgins did it. And he did the mini Moog, but like dramatically, and it's way overboard. And it was funny as hell, and it was good. And somebody sent it to me. The guy did the whole thing, the guitar solo, everything. I should reach out to the guy and send him a autograph thing that he won't give a shit about. But
that must, but that must be awesome. Like, it must be awesome to have all those sounds that you've created. You know, like I hear Grace American Hero theme song all the time. You know, it's on different shows and all this stuff. It must. I mean, how is that for you, having created that? Does it?
My gig, you know, there's the difference between your old man and me. You know, your old man would get in that red Thunderbird with his, you know, with the hair thing he had going on. His hair. Anybody that's listening that knew him knew that he was the only white guy in the world with that haircut. You know, he looked like Little Richard or something, you know. But his hair was so perfect and puffed up and everything. And he'd get in this red Thunderbird, 56, right?
Yeah,
56. And he'd drive down the freeway and just dying for everybody to recognize him from the Living logo.
And well, yeah, I remember helping pick out that logo. If people don't know who my dad is just by the name Stephen J. Cannell, he created so many shows in the 80s and 90s, and he was the guy who typed on the typewriter and pulled out the piece of paper and it made a C. And I remember picking out of like 200 different, he probably showed them to you too. You know, which one do you think is going to be the best one? Yeah.
Well, because I had to write the music, bam, bam, bitter down. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I had to write this little 5-second deal. But he and I are 100% different. He was dying to go to the 7-Eleven and have people go, wow, you're that producer with this picture on the end of the logo, or you're the guy that's in, you know, Renegade or whatever, you know. And I'm going, Cannell, what is wrong with you? Why do you want it? I don't know. I just dig it. I think it's really cool. You know, and the truth is he was never in a band like I was in the band at 16. And, you know, so he had this itch that he needed to scratch, you know. And with me, it was just I had the best gig in the world. So what does it feel like? The truth is, even when you just stuck that your phone up there and played it, it's I could remember writing it. I can remember playing it. I could remember doing it. I could remember having a hit record. But there's a weird disconnect. There's a weird thing of, and the best it's ever been articulated was James Taylor wrote a song once called "Hey Mister, That's Me Up on the Jukebox," and he's sitting in a bar, and all of a sudden he comes on the radio. I mean, on the jukebox, and it's like the bartender doesn't know it's him, and he wants to say, "God, that's me." And it actually has happened to me many times, not many times, but a number of times. And the best it ever happened was in the summer of 75, I was on the Hollywood Freeway going from the Valley, where I still live, down to MGM Records, which had released the theme from the Rockford Files. And it was a big hit. It was on KHJ at the time. And I was just at the Barham overpass. And I'm in bumper-to-bumper traffic, and I'm headed down to the record company to help promote the record, blah, blah, blah. My windows are down. There's a guy parked next to me, or stopped next to me in a car, and he's got the same radio station I have, and all of a sudden, ba-da-down, and he reaches down and grabs it and turns it up, cranks it. And then he realizes that it's coming in stereo from somewhere. And, oh, the guy next to me is listening to the same thing. And he looks over, and he gives me a thumbs up, like, isn't that fucking cool? And I look, and I almost said, that's me. Oh, look.
That's mine.
And I just went, yeah. And I gave him a thumbs up, and I went like, wow, what a weird out-of-body experience this is. This is the weirdest thing that ever happened. And, you know, it's happened in various different ways over the years. I know it's me. I remember doing it. But it's almost not me alone. It's me and Pete and your old man.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, God, that was us. That was us then. You know, I can still do it. I still do it every week. But, God, it's like, I don't know. There's a little bit of an amazement that I actually make a living doing this shit.
Yeah. But it's amazing because you've composed two things for me separately. I did two different PSAs, and you did one for me last year. And it's just, it's amazing to watch you work. It's amazing for you because with me, you just watched the film that I had shot. And to watch you layer all the different sounds on top of each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there something you like to start with first? Like a set, like, is it piano or is it, I mean, what is, or can it, or is it just the visual that makes you think of?
Yeah, it's more basic than that. It's even more down to the bare metal. First of all, everything you shoot, everything that your old man ever wrote is in a tempo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, you guys don't even know it, but he wrote in a tempo.
Right.
The words tumble out in a tempo. And then a really good director comes in there and shoots it in a tempo.
Right.
Okay? And then where the tempo really comes up, becomes apparent to everyone is when they edit it.
Right.
They cut it in a tempo.
Right.
And then I sit, you know, I'm completely Rain Man. You know.
Rain more, Man?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Because I got no brains. So there's no, it's not like I'm smart.
You know, I'm going to remember that when you say I have no brains. I'll bring that up later.
You know, but the truth is, you know, I look at the picture and I go, well, what were you thinking when you wrote that wonderful piece of thinking? Are you shitting me? Thinking? I'm not thinking anything. You know, I'm just doing. I'm just, you know, it's music. So there's no thinking involved. There's this thing happens, you know, and it's like your old man and I would get together and he'd go, what are you doing? He goes, I'm just listening to the voices in my head and typing it as fast as I can in that hieroglyphics that he called English, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Steve Cannell was extremely dyslexic, so he spelled, the only guy I've ever met spelled worse than me. So, you know, I mean, he was like...
Well, you know, it's funny. He wrote something out for me once. He typed it out, and he came, and I was supposed to read it, or I was supposed to do something. I can't remember what it was, but he came in, and he was like, okay, well, let me explain it to you, and because I'm dyslexic, too, I'm like, you don't even bother. I can read it.
Yeah.
You don't need to worry about it.
Takes one to know one, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And neither, both of you would be lost without Grace Gershio, so.
Oh, I know, and Grace, what was Grace saying? It was a damn third finger that fucked everything up.
That's exactly right. Perfect.
Because my father used to type with two fingers on both sides, and the middle finger would always get in the way, and it would push an extra key that wasn't supposed to be there. And so she was the only one who could decipher it.
The only one. That was such muddled bullshit until she got a hold of it, and
right.
Then it was brilliant. You know, it's right. Like, okay, well, that's what he meant to say.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's like, what was he writing? Is he really a writer? No, you know what? It was Grace was the writer. He wasn't the writer.
He was a Martian, you know, but that's okay, which is why he and I are friends. But the truth is that once a composer figures out the tempo, once you feel the tempo of any scene or any piece, that's the key that unlocks the magic door. You know, now the music's easy. Well, it was always easy, but I mean, it's really easy now once you got what the tempo is.
Right.
So the process isn't a thinking thing. It's a feeling thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of the process is the big secret that you guys don't know, that all of us know, is, and you come to my studio and you go, man, this guy is really good at his job. He's really talented. There's 10 good ways to do every picture that you're going to bring to me. It's hard to screw it up. I mean, if you bring me a good picture, it's hard to screw up.
Yep.
It's a hanging curveball. It's like, there's 10 good ways to do this. Now, what's the hard part? The hard part is code breaking. Because you guys, you don't speak music. You speak English. And you speak film. And you speak, you know, from a two-shot to a one-shot to a pan thing and a back and around. And you're storytellers, you know?
Right.
I'm just a dirtbag musician. We come in through the kitchen, we play for the rich people and leave through the kitchen, you know? I mean, it's like, what? What did she say? Oh, well, you know, I got to break the code. What does she need to make this picture more dramatic? B, what does she want? Now, how do I meld what she wants with what she really needs to make the picture better? And I got to write something that doesn't make me, you know, puke. So, you know, I mean, because it's hard to be.
Yeah, but see, I don't think you give yourself enough credit, because just like in directing, there's 150 different ways to shoot something.
Yep.
You know, and it's subjective. What we do is subjective. You have a talent. You have a point of view, and either people like it or they don't like it. Right.
Right.
So, for me as a director, you know, you could have a scene where you're like, not so great. And then you as a composer get a hold of it and make it so much better, you know, because the music brings out that extra piece that maybe you wasn't in the words or whatever. And you can, I mean, I'm amazed all the time, because when I edit my shows, usually there's temp music in it or it's not, you know, and then I see it air and it's amazing. You know, so it's like you sit there and you say, well, I don't, but you do, because it's obviously a great skill that you have, because you keep working on these amazing shows.
You know,
take the compliment.
All right. Complete honesty. I don't know. I agree. There's magic involved. There is some sort of hoodoo going on that... where, you know, if you take our parts,
mm-hmm.
and you separate them and you look at them, you go, pretty good. Okay, yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. But when it's right and it all comes together, there is magic to this thing of life, and it is completely collaborative. As opposed to writing a piece of music for concert or writing a hit record or writing a piece of, you know, a song that, you know, Jimmy Webb or Bob Dylan or Paul Simon or somebody or Springsteen writes a song and it stands by itself. I don't write that. I write collaborative music. My music makes your pictures hopefully better. And there's some sort of synergy magic thing to, you know, to an idiot like me, you know, looking at a picture without music and going, well, it could be this, you know, right. Why don't we do that? You know, oh God, this would be cool, you know, and that's different than Dylan, you know, sitting in there going, if you're ever traveling to the North Country far, you know, that's a different genius, you know, and that's a real genius. And I'm just part of a team, you know, and I really believe that. I mean, can I make your picture better? Yep, I can. If you bring me a really good picture, I can help. If you bring me a really bad picture, it's going to be a really bad picture with some pretty good music. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I can't save you. I can just make you maybe a little bit better, you know.
But you also have, not only did you work with my father and do almost every one of his shows, but you also worked with Stephen Bochco.
Yep.
And did a majority of his shows, right?
Almost everything he did, yeah.
Almost everything he did. Yeah. And did you meet Stephen through my dad?
Of course. Yeah, you know, your old man calls me up and goes, hey, I got this guy, the really nice guy, really, really talented, really smart, and he's sort of on the edge at Universal here. They kind of don't know that his deal's almost up and, you know, and we're going to do something together. I go, oh, okay, good. And he said, do you want to have lunch? And I go, sure, of course. You know, so we go to lunch, you know, two Jews and the whitest guy in the world, your old man. And then we go to lunch and immediately we both just start dumping on Stephen. Bochco and I are dumping on Cantle. It's the funniest thing ever. You know, he's going, oh my God, you people really stick together, don't you? You know. By the way, I'm the first Jew your father ever even, like, had he thought we had horns or something, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, God, he's great. He's just the best, you know. Do you know the story about, so I buy my first really exotic car. I buy a Ferrari. And your old man's down at the boat in Newport. And you guys are someplace, I don't know, your mom's traveling with you. And it's just me and him. I call him, hey, what are you doing? I'm just down here at the boat. What are you doing? I said, well, I got this new car I want to show you. He goes, well, when I have dinner, I'll barbecue.
God.
Yeah, yeah. I said, well, can we go out? He goes, oh, yeah, we can go out. Jesus, do you have to bust my balls about everything? Yeah. I said, well, I'll come down. He goes, that'd be great. Good. Come down. So I drive all the way down. And at the time, I owned a little house at La Costa, which was, you know, that's another half an hour from Newport. So we go out to dinner and we have a couple of glasses of wine. And I go, hey, why don't you get in a Ferrari? It's, you know, it's really cool. I got this little house at La Costa. Forget, we won't stay on the boat. We'll go down to La Costa. We'll go to the spa tomorrow. We'll take a steam. We'll go out for a run together. We'll take a steam. We'll get a massage. And he's looking at me like I'm speaking Swahili or something. I'm going,
massage.
No shit. He goes, I'm not into that. I said, into what part of that aren't you into, you idiot? He goes, wait a second. He goes, okay, I was trying to spare your feelings. He goes, okay, this is an ethnic thing. This is a Jew thing. I said, what? He goes, no, it is. He goes, you guys get in a steam bath and you swat yourself with all that stuff and you call each other Solly and you smoke cigars. And I'm going, are you kidding me? He goes, no, I know that's what you do. And then you let other guys like put oil on you and touch you. I go, you are the whitest guy I've ever met. You're the most homophobic person I've ever met. You're ridiculous. We stayed on the boat that night.
Yeah, yeah, and he's homophobic and you're staying on the boat. Okay, I won't ask any other questions.
No. I was always, yeah. Do you know that I never hugged your father?
Really?
Never.
I can't believe that.
Oh, come on. We shook hands. we shook hands. And I mean, I've seen your father in good, bad, ugly. You know, I've seen your father under the worst circumstances, the best circumstances. I've seen your father, you know, every kind of which way, including, you know, 2 days before he died, you know, never hugged. Loved each other like brothers. Never. Oh,
well, I know you guys did. I mean, it's like it. You know, he'd always be like Mike this and Mike that, and you know. And again, it's like I've saw you my whole life.
Yep.
You know,
the coolest thing I ever—one of the coolest things I ever did to him was—and you were there. You were—I came to St. John's in Santa Monica. You know, you were really sick, really sick.
Oh.
You know, just right before he passed away. So I come in, and everybody was really nice. They let me—they all cleared out, and I just me and your old man, and he's like out of it, you know. And bad, really bad. And he kind of comes out of this fog and he looks up and he goes, "Hey." I said, "Hey." I said, "How you doing?" He goes, "I'm all right." I said, "Okay, I got some news for you." He said, "What?" I said, "You want the good news or the bad news?" He said, "Well, give me the bad news." I said, "Look, if you don't get a hold of yourself and, you know, kind of get back in touch with reality and try and find a way to get all this stomach problems that you got going on stopped. This is actually going to kill you. You know, you got to calm down now and stop your imagination and stop with all these hallucinations and all this shit you're going." He goes, "What's the good news?" I said, "You know what? You look exactly like me now." His head was shaved. I've been bald forever. And he went, "Oh God, just shoot me now. Just shoot me now."
One of the funniest stories was when I was an AD and he was working on Renegade. He played Dutch Dixon. It was his way of trying to be an actor. But, you know, he was just kind of a hack. But anyway, they scripted that he would go in the water. And my father loved his hair so much that he would never get it wet. And so because it was scripted, he did it. But I stood there with a Polaroid camera, and as he was coming out of the bay of San Diego with a wet head, I took Polaroid pictures of him. And he kept pointing at me going, "What? Don't stop that. Don't you," you know. And then when he had to shave his head when he was sick, we were all like, and by the way, he had the most perfectly round head of anybody I've ever seen.
He looked great because he kept his goatee even through chemo. Lost all his hair, but his head was perfect. There was it was
perfectly round. And we're like, just tell people you got cast in some, you know, some like feature where you're a badass like killer
exactly
or something.
That's exactly right. You know, you're in jail and you're part of the Aryan Brotherhood.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. So I have a question for you that I usually ask at the beginning, but we started that I couldn't ask you. So your very first job that you ever had in as a musician, what was that? And how did it feel on your first day?
Night.
Night?
First night.
So what was your first job?
It was playing piano for a band called Frankie Knight and the Jesters on Pico and Genesee, which is two blocks east of Fairfax on Pico. It's now, I think, an electronics store or something, or a washer dryer store or something. It was a nightclub called Mama's or Alvo Turno's, which was a Italian name for somebody's village or something. And I got this gig. I was just 16. And I got this gig playing piano for this band. The band, before they added a keyboard player, was just piano, drums, bass, and this really good singer named Frankie Knight. And I was at a rehearsal 2 weeks before, and I was just sitting there with some friends, and they didn't know the chord changes to this one song, and I did. And I said, "You guys are playing the wrong chords. I don't mean to be pushy, but do you want to know the right chords?" So there was a piano on stage. I walked up, played the song. And the singer, Frankie Knight, said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Mike." And he said, "You want a gig?" And I said, "Yep." So I got $15 a night, five sets, 45 minutes on, 15 minutes off, plus dinner. They fed us. And that was my first gig, and it felt like I'm in the band. Are you shitting me? I'm in the band. And it was great.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I have another question now. We'll go back to my family stuff. But when you wrote the theme to Greatest American Hero, which, again, I will use my low-budget way of doing it, which I have to throw a shout-out to my daughter, Gracie, who told me how to do this. Because I was like, I don't know how to do it. And she's like, Mom, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
So, but I heard, and I don't even know if it's true, but my dad said that he helped write the lyrics.
Yeah. He sort of tweaked the lyrics. A really talented guy named Stephen Geyer wrote those lyrics. And first of all, the whole thing is completely screwy because you know how it happened. The networks never come up with anything. They're idiots. They never come up with anything original. So Superman was a... Yeah, go ahead.
You are?
Yep.
He's playing it.
Oh, good.
People sing this still.
Crazy, huh?
Isn't it crazy?
Really weird. So what happened was, the network said Superman was a hit, so they went to Cannell and said, okay, we want you to do Superman. Well, he's never going to, he's not going to just rip something off. He's not going to just do it, normal. He's a Martian. So he goes, okay, let's see here. How do I do this? Okay, it's great. The guy's not Superman. It's the suit. Okay. How does he get the suit? Oh, aliens give it to him. Oh, that's smart. Okay. Well, it can't be normal. So he has to lose the directions and he can't figure out how to fly and he keeps hitting walls and he's just really screwed up. And then he brings in a former CIA guy to be his handler so he twists the whole thing. So, he came and he sat down with me and he said, I want a song. I said, you want a song? Oh, my God. First of all, you got this completely twisted, crazy idea on how to do Superman. And now you want a song. And I said, well, I've been working with this guy, Steve Geyer, who's, really brilliant guy, really smart. And so Geyer came in and said, hey, let's make the analogy with love. Let's make it about being in love rather than, we don't want to talk about flying a suit that can't fly right because you lost the directions. Good idea. So he wrote the basic lyric and then Cannell said, tweak this word or that word or everything else. In his mind, he probably wrote it, but it's okay. That's your old man.
I know. He was like, and I was like, when I was coming here tonight, I was thinking, I'm asking Mike that question because my dad always used to say, well, yeah, I wrote the lyrics to that song. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay. I was at camp actually, and didn't it go top 10?
It was number one.
It was number one, yeah. So I would listen to it, and all my friends would be singing it at camp, and I'd be like, that was my daddy.
It was Stephen that wrote the lyrics, but not Stephen Cannell. It was Stephen Geyer that wrote the lyrics. Stephen Cannell wrote the script and had the truth is, not unlike almost everybody in Hollywood that wants to be something other than their gig, they all want to be in a band. Everybody wants to be in a band. And you know what? I don't blame them. No. It's the best gig. It is the coolest. That's why, great big giant actors, that are huge stars, they also play guitar. Do they really? Really? They really? Show me one of them that really plays great. Well, they play okay, yeah, but everybody, in the last 100 years, what do you really, what's the dream job? I want to be a musician. I don't know why it's that way, but it really is. And you know, I just feel at my age, I just feel lucky to still kind of be in the band.
Well, I think you are not kind of in the band. I think you're still in the band.
I hope I
am. You still do the music for Hell Street or for
Law and Order.
Law and Order.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So it's, and do you ever, like, because you do the music for every episode, right?
Yep.
So does it ever feel like a grind to you?
No, I'm so stupid. You know, honest to God, I would never lie to you. I'm so limited intellectually. I'm so easily satisfied that, I mean, I've been writing the same music for Dick Wolf for 25 years.
Yeah.
And getting way overpaid. I hope you're listening to this, Dick. But
we'll send it to him. It's going to be on iTunes.
Oh, it's perfect. But, every once in a while, I'll do something different. That's the only time I ever hear from this idiot. He'll call me up and he goes, what are you doing? And I wasn't even sure he was even looking at episodes, you know,
right.
These days, you know.
Right.
He's just counting money up there, you know. But no, he's actually looking at it. He goes, you're so stupid. Don't change it. Just keep going. I go, well, why don't you just cut up what I did 17 years ago and put it in? No, keep writing. This is good. He goes, look, you and I are in platinum handcuffs. Yeah, he's kind of right. So, and the truth is, I still like going to work and being in the same kind of mode and writing the same kind of music. Maybe it's the exact same music. I don't know. I get new sounds every year and I tweak stuff and I change a little something. Basically, I'm in the band and the audience wants to hear Proud Mary, so I'm going to fucking play Proud Mary because I'm just lucky to be in the band.
Yeah, but you know what? It's funny. It's like when I bring my stuff to you, or there's no template. So it's like you really kind of go crazy.
Yeah,
you
because I'm so happy to be writing something different. You know, you bring me something that I hadn't seen before. You know, not that Law and Order is repetitive, but it's, you know, all episodic TV is pretty.
You don't want to break the formula, right?
No,
it works.
Yeah, it's working. So yeah. Don't change nothing. But at any rate, you know, when somebody brings me something new, it is exciting because, you know, it's not blank paper, but it's blank inspiration because that's a kind of a two-bit word and sort of a phony-ass word. But the truth is, when you bring me a piece of film, I sit there with a clear mind. I have no preconceived notions. I look at the film and actually get inspired. You go, oh, look. Oh, it's this. It's that. It makes me feel this way. Now, what can I bring to the table that heightens those feelings? How can I make the sadder parts sadder, the happier parts happier, sexier parts sexier, the scarier parts scarier? That's my job. My job is to take your stuff and inject, you know, the steroid that is music.
Right. Well, and it's amazing to me because as an episodic director, I never get to that process.
Right.
You know, I turn my episode in. It's my little baby that I've made. And then I go with God. And let's see what happens. And then when it airs on TV is when I see what the original score is. And there's sometimes where they put like temp music in that they can't afford.
Right.
And you're like, oh, that's perfect for the scene. And then you're like.
And you get a letdown because it ain't the Stones.
Yeah, exactly. You're like looking at it going, okay, well, what was done was fine, but it's not that song, that name song that, you know.
Yep.
But so it's fascinating to me, the whole process, because I do know how much sound helps a picture.
Well, you know, to tell the truth, you know, that's the great part of episodic TV for composers and the horrible part for directors and the horrible part for composers in films and the great part for directors in films. I hope none of my composer friends are listening because
they're not.
Oh, good. This is sacrilege what I'm going to say. So you take like the Revenant, right?
Right.
As a composer, I should hate that score. Two different composers and actually four different sources of music, because not only did they have two really, really accomplished composers, but then they took classical music and laid it in there the way it was originally conceived, and they took classical music and they sweetened it. They played music along with it. They actually enhanced it. Well, Hindemith wasn't really thinking of this when he wrote that. He did. If he'd have been born now, he would have written this. And they put something on top of a legendary piece of classical music. I should hate that. As a composer, I should go, bullshit, don't you do that. You hire John Williams or Tommy Newman or Randy or me or James Newton Howard, and that's the score. And you know what? I go see that movie and I go, this is awesome. This is fucking awesome. This is so good. I can't believe it. I should hate this, but it's wonderful. Now, how did it happen? Really, the director. The director said, I can't actually write the music, but I can conceive it. I can direct it. I can edit it. I can amalgamate it. I can really almost be the composer, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Now, if I was a composer on that, I would have wanted to slit my wrists or his throat. But what's the real job of the music in a film? To make the film better. The music made the film so much better in that case. And it's happened a lot lately. You know, my wife Patty and I got into The Nick. So we turn on the pilot of The Nick. It's a story about 1900, medicine in 1900. We're sitting in bed, we're watching a thing. It's Soderbergh. It's Cliff Martinez, his guy. He's a drummer. He's a, you know, he's a sequence guy, you know. Okay, he's not a real composer like me or James Newton Howard or Tommy Newman or, you know, not a real composer. And, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm going, Patty, I don't think this shit works. This is, that's all wrong. It's 1900 and it sounds like it sounds like The Who. It sounds like, no, it's not really 2016, but it's 2000. What is it? By the second episode, I go, this music is so good. This is so good for the picture. It doesn't make sense on paper. It's wrong on paper. It's like crossing the line sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is wrong. No, it's not. It's art. It never stands still. It doesn't follow rules. It's art.
It's subjective.
And it's subjective, and it never stays the same. It's what happened yesterday is irrelevant. We're going this way. Right. And that's so in the music thing, all those guys that come in with all the ego going, oh, I know exactly how it ought to be. You know what? It's art.
Yeah.
There's no cookie cutter bullshit with this. It's art. It's supposed to just breathe and live and change, and you know, and that's the good part of it.
Well, the thing about art I've always said is that if it makes you react, and it could make you react negatively, it could make you react positively, then it did its job. If it makes you think and it makes you feel, then that's what it was supposed to do.
That's the game. That's yeah. The whole game.
Yeah. But I think it's amazing that's your perspective, because a lot of people would get stuck in the ego, would say, well, you know, you can't do that. But it's really amazing, too, the older I get, and I don't know if you feel this way, just seeing how the younger generation changes everything, you know. And sometimes they don't do it correctly, or they do some things where you're like, oh. But other things are just, like when I watch YouTube, the stuff that my kids watch, it's amazing to me how much talent there is out there and how many people are creating art, you know.
Hey, you know, back in the old days, I can remember Pete saying, and my mother and father saying, oh, no, it always comes back around. It repeats itself like it was a circle. And it goes back to the beginning. I've come to the conclusion it never goes back to the beginning. It repeats, but it goes forward as it repeats.
Right.
So it's something changes about it. It keeps going forward. You know, it's like the folky guys now, well, they're not Pete Seeger and they're not Bob Dylan and they're not Joan Baez. They're not Peter, Paul, and Mary, your dad's favorite. It doesn't repeat exactly. It repeats with forward motion so that it's always changing. That's art. That's the exciting part of it. That's the cool part of it. That's the part that makes John Williams still a monster today. And some 19-year-old kid just rolling out of SC or Berkeley or some or no place with an idea. That's what makes Cliff Martinez go, man, here's how we're doing this. And it be brand new and just go, oh, shit, this is so good.
Yeah. I mean, do you, well, I know that like our friend Terrence O'Hara, you were telling me about his son and how talented his son was, who he now works for you.
No.
Or works with you.
Thank you.
On, you know, job per job is what you were saying. But how does that make you feel when you find somebody like that, where you truly feel that they have a gift?
You know, it's timeless. It's ageless. It's colorless. That's the cool thing about our gig. I mean, the music gig. You know what? You can quack until you're blue in the face. You can posture, you can talk, you can have tons of credits and tons of hardware in terms of awards and all the rest, and you can be rich as shit. You know what? How's it sound? Let me hear your stuff. Here's a guitar, let's play. Here's a piano, let's play. And all the quacking is finished. The playing starts and everybody knows. You know, I've seen fire and rain. I've walked in, you know, 24 years of age. Hello, Mr. Charles. So nice to meet you. Hey, Ray, how you doing? Let's go. You know, that makes a man out of you. You sit down with Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Ray Charles, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, Johnny Cash, guys like that. And you go, we're not screwing around here, guys. This is the real deal. You know, I mean, like, okay, there's all the talking stops and the playing starts. And then it's, okay, let's see. You know, when you stand in front of an orchestra in L.A., especially in L.A., and you got, you know, 60 of the greatest players on the face of the planet, and you got a baton in your hand, and you go, okay, here's my stuff. Here we go. 3, 4, boom. No talking. Doesn't matter, you know, how... You know, nothing matters except the music. You know, it doesn't matter, black, white, nothing matters. Just play me your stuff, buddy. You don't have to talk about it. Don't tell me how good you are. Play your thing.
Because that's what shows you how good you are.
Well, or...
how bad you are.
Yeah.
But I like to end on how good you are. Mike, thank you so much for coming and being my guest. And I'm in awe and I love you so much. And thank you for being here. And that's our show. Maybe I'll have you come back and we can continue because I feel like we have more to talk about.
Anytime, because I actually do love you.
So now the Love Fest is over and we're done.
Good.